Quick question for you. What's a product that you think way more designers should be using? I know my answer, hands down, it is Raycast. It's like my shortcut to everything on my computer. It's how I interface with AI, how I organize my desktop, how I find the right emoji. It's even how I search for my Figma files. The more that I use Raycast, the easier it is to stay in flow while I work. And that's why I'm constantly recommending it to designers. So if you're not using Raycast yet, head to dive.club/Raycast to learn more. That's R-A-Y-C-A-S-T. Okay, now onto the episode.
The fact is, you can build something really high fidelity, indistinguishable from production, and show it to like Zuck in a Zuck review. That's worth like so much value for you personally and also for the company, right? But like if you show like a Figma prototype where like 90% of it's not clickable and you click somewhere and these like pink rectangles flashing, it's like no, click here, or like drag here, like no, you can't do that in a user test, right? There's no way. If I were to talk to most people in the industry today and I was like, oh, I don't spend that much time in Figma, they'll be like, oh, well, you're not a designer, right? That's to me, that's the line that's blurring. It's because all of a sudden the bar for entry is lowering drastically for anyone to get in.
Welcome to Dive Club. My name is Rid, and this is where designers never stop learning. Today, we're talking with Julius Tarn, who's the ultimate generalist designer and engineer. Just listen to this background real quick. He started the design tools team at Facebook, where he made a massive impact on products like Origami. He then went on to freelance as a design engineer for products like Felt, Anthropic. He even prototyped some of the early AI features for Arc. Now, at this point, he decides that he wants to get out of his comfort zone a bit. So, of course, he goes and gets a job as an engineer at Linear. Now, if you're a traditional designer and you want to learn what it takes to make the jump to be someone who can build your ideas, then this is the episode for you. So let's start by meeting Julius.
So in school, I chose to focus on industrial design. And a big reason for that was that I felt like it was the harder of the two choices we had at the time, which was communication and industrial. And this is a theme that like follows me throughout my life. It's like, I really want to be in the most uncomfortable position that I can be, yet still have this potential to succeed at whatever that is through just like pure hard work and like learning. So the industrial design department was pretty heavily couched in a lot of older kind of like research-based methods. Like visual aesthetic was like not a thing. We focused a lot on process. And so when I graduated and I got my first job at an agency, that's how I approached my work there. And for me, the most formative part of all of that experience was this idea of like prototyping, right? Just like, you have an idea, like, yeah, just try it, right? Just make it, right? And in industrial design, you make tons of foam models. This is like, you know, kind of pre-3D printing days. You're expected to just churn through stuff. You're expected to go out to stores and buy competing products, cut them up. We Frankenstein them together and be like, okay, like, is this thing good? On one hand, you could say like, hey, that just sounds like, you know, trial and error. You're just throwing stuff against the wall. To some extent, yes. But I think like in order to do it effectively, right, it's kind of like this idea of like, if you give a monkey a typewriter, they're going to type out like Shakespeare at some point. It's like, sure, potentially, but what time are you talking about? I think for me, the thing that I really enjoy is really how do we condense that time through a combination of my approach, my experience, and taste, ultimately, right? Because like when you're prototyping, you have to be really selective with the things you spend your time making and trying out. I still approach design the same way I do back then, just with totally different materials. Like instead of like physical materials like foam, plastic, rubber, TPU, that kind of stuff. Now I'm now thinking about things through code.
Can we zoom in on this period of time where I was looking at your LinkedIn and I think it starts around like 2021. You've left Facebook and you have engineer and designer as your title in like 3 or 4 consecutive roles. Talk to me about those experiences. What were the types of things that you were working on? And I'd really like to learn more about this, you know, prototyping process and how you're shaping ideas as someone who's approaching it from both the design angle and the engineering angle.
I'm really interested in working with startups mostly because it's about like new technology. They're trying new things, work much smaller teams, et cetera, right? So just through trying these different projects, I eventually figure out like I either sell myself as a designer to a startup and I'm pulled into these awkward situations where either you're used as kind of like more of a brand designer, marketing designer, or you're in a position where you're really purely just executing on the CEO's visions. You're really just like mocking things up that they don't really have capability to. So that's how I kind of ended up in a space where I kind of found this niche where when I talk to a new client, it's never about like, I'm going to deliver a certain artifact. Like when you do brand design, you know, you kind of talk with clients, you're like, oh, like we'll do like three revisions. And there's an expectation of deliverables at the end, right? There's going to be one logo mark, and like we're going to set you up with all your social media presence, your website, whatever, right? But in the work that I do, there's no such thing I can promise. I'm sure you've talked about like freelance pricing and stuff with like people like Kevin before, but like, you know, I have a really hard time doing what they call value-based pricing. Like I have to sell my time. The very nature of my work, I cannot promise any result, right? The thing that you get with me is you get like a reliable partner. I'm here with you and I'm here to help you answer your questions. That's how I pitch it. That's really what blocks any startup from succeeding. It's like there's a bajillion ways to go. Which way do we go? And I'm here to have the skill sets and the taste to help you answer the most important questions as quickly as we can. The literal things I do are, sure, design and engineering, right? I am sometimes in Figma. Most of the time I am building some prototype in code, or I'm actually writing production code. But the deliverable, the thing that the client actually gets out of value from me, is we're way closer to product market fit, right? We're way closer to this vision that we had than we were when Julia started. And it's worth, you know, however much we pay him per hour.
Is there an example or a feature or product that you worked on that you could use to go a little bit deeper to help people understand what that question answering process looks like on your end?
A pretty simple example is there's a startup called Felt.com. They're like a Figma for map making, right? If you work in real estate, or you work in, you know, political planning, or you work in, you know, any sort of like event planning, you're going to be drawing maps. And historically, there's either the enterprise level GIS tools, which are like really, really terrible and horrible to use, or you use like Google Maps and you screenshot stuff and you draw stuff in PowerPoint. And so like they're looking at like, hey, there's this middle ground here where people are professionals and they want to collaborate on these things, and they can't go about sending PowerPoint decks to each other, right, long term. So when I first talked to them, the kind of this idea of like, what is this going to be was a little fuzzy to me still, right? It was this idea that, yes, sure, there's a market here, but like, what exactly do we sell these people? And also, what is like practical and possible? So when I first reached out to talk to them, they're actually like, no, we're trying to hire someone full time. And, you know, a couple months later or whatever, we touched base again. And this particular experience really helped shape how I sold myself later down the line. It was really this idea, like they want to hire someone full time, but for some reason during the zero interest rate policy days, it was just really hard to find someone that was a front end type person or a highly skilled designer who had technical experience who could really help them just like iterate quickly. So the way I sold it was like, hey, like I'm going to work with you until you find that person, right? Like, let me help you make progress and not burn your runway for no reason. So specifically, the work that we did my first week was literally just like, okay, for this map making product, we want a bunch of drawing tools. What are the unique tools that make this tool go beyond what, you know, like just drawing with like MS Paint on top of a screenshot go? And so my first week was really like, okay, like let's pick one thing, right? And so we picked this idea of like shading. So this idea of like, okay, whenever you're drawing a map, sure, you can draw routes, you can draw like, you know, markers, you can draw like little symbols. Like those are pretty obvious stuff like most mapping tools do have. But this idea of like, well, we want to indicate some sort of area, but it's more of like a highlight. It's just like emphasizing this area, but it's not, you're not like drawing a line around it, right? You're kind of like filling it in. So there's a lot of these like little decisions, tiny little edge cases that kind of collect up into what is the final product. And that's really the challenge there. It's like you want someone there who has this like taste, this like design, like either instinct or experience, or at least some sort of process. And then you have someone who understands like, okay, like this is how we have to represent it in the technical software world, right? However we represent it in the database, what trade-offs we make so that it's Figma-like, right? Like it has to be able to send like tiny little packets in between all the computers so that it's like lightning fast, that you get like live updating and multiplayer kind of capability. And also just like look good too. And so that was one of the examples where it was like basically like a 6 to 7 month long project where it started as, hey, let's prototype this one tool, the shading tool. And it's like, okay, we got to a good point. And then like, let's make more tool. Okay, let's do text now. Oh shit, there's all these problems with text. How do we make it like work in production, not just this playground that you built in Code Sandbox? And eventually it's like, okay, like now we need UI, right? So it's like kind of we're building this plane, you know, in flight as we're like testing this with users and uncovering like whether there's product market fit, right? So that's why like I talk about my work as like design engineering or engineering design, because it's just like so hard to define, right? Like I find this like really arbitrary industry definition of like what is engineering, what is design. It doesn't fit what I think. Right? To me, it's like the idea of like doing something that's super abstract or super distanced away from code. It feels odd to me because I really, the closer I can get to the real thing, the more accurate this kind of feedback loop that I'm working on is going to be, right? The me trying some idea, giving it to someone to try, them saying it sucks or it's good, and then like trying it again. Like I want this feedback loop to be as tight as possible.
I mean, are there ever times where you are exploring ideas in Figma versus a sandbox?
Yes, Figma is really good at the phase you are where you're just, you don't want to think too much about constraints, right? You just want to like try something out. You just want to see it and feel it without having to commit to as much time, right? If it were faster to code something than it would be to draw something in Figma, no one would use Figma, but that's not how it is, right? Like it's really like a speed trade-off. So personally for me, I spend way more time like sketching stuff out on a notebook than I do in Figma. I can make a scribble and I can skip the Figma stage and go directly into code because I know what I'm thinking, but sometimes you just need to get something out there, get something out of your brain so you can like move on to the next, yeah.
I want to talk a little bit more about this arbitrary line between design and engineering because you use this phrase independent software creative, which I love, but also it makes a lot of sense through this freelance lens where, you know, you're working for yourself, you get to carve whatever the heck role you want. Whereas, you know, more modern product teams, they do have these lines. They do have more clearly defined roles. And you joined in the last like year and a half or so as more of like a traditional engineer at Linear. I'd love to hear more about like how you made that decision, but also like, are there ways in this type of role where you're still able to flex your design muscles?
The reason I did that was more of this thing I talked about before of like, I just want to be in an uncomfortable place. And the last time I was a tenured designer or whatever at a startup, didn't work out so well. So I wanted to come in with like fresh eyes, you know, beginner mindset. So that was the main reason why I decided to apply as a, you know, like as an engineer for that role. At any software startup, the most impact you can have is that you ship stuff, right? Any employee that generally just like puts out more features or puts out more bug fixes, you are going to be valuable no matter what your title is, right? You can be a QA person who fixes bugs. You can be a designer who like, you know, files bugs or like goes into CSS and like kind of like raises the bar for things. You can be an engineer who like whenever you build something, you're always like making sure things are accessible, whatever it is, right? Like you're bringing your own personal passion, kind of your personal thesis. And you have to thread this line very carefully between like what the company values and what you value, because it's a Venn diagram, right? And you always want to like make sure that you're staying in the center. When I was thinking about what company to join, I was always trying to figure out like, okay, like what does this company value? Like if I wanted to do the type of stuff that I really wanted to do at this company, would it be chill? And not only would it be chill, would it be appreciated and would it be rewarded? When I joined Facebook, it was kind of transitioning from this like old guard, which is that a lot of the product designers that were originally hired, like 90% of them coded. That was a requirement when you interviewed as a product designer late 2000s, right? I actually went through this interview when I was in college and I failed it massively. I came in this moment where there was this kind of transition of skill sets where like, yeah, the previous skill set was appreciated, but more likely than not, you can't really contribute to production code, mostly because like it was kind of a pain in the ass to like being a developer at the time at Facebook. It took a long time to develop stuff. It was just like a pretty big and gnarly code base. And so like a lot of the designers instead, they spent their time really investing into prototyping tools. And that was where Framer was born. Framer is from Facebook. Origami was technically from Apple through Mike Manis and Pushpop Press, but you know, he brought it to Facebook and it was really developed and formed into a real tool there. So a lot of these kind of like tools and this kind of idea of like prototyping as part of a designer's toolkit really came out of this environment where if we could, we would code, but we cannot practically. So we're going to make this tool that brings us as close to coding as we can, right? That's why like to me, a lot of people who use Origami, they get over that kind of like learning hump of like, oh, this is such a complicated spaghetti tool. Like the fact is you can build something really high fidelity, indistinguishable from production, and show it to like Zuck in a Zuck review, that is like, that's worth like so much value for you personally and also for the company, right? But like if you show like a Figma prototype where like 90% of it's not clickable and you click somewhere and these like pink rectangles flashing, it's like, no, click here, or like drag here. Like no, you can't do that in a user test, right? There's no way. You would get so much noise. You would not get anything valuable.
We might as well go down the tool rabbit hole then, because again, like talking about this arbitrary line between design and engineering, like, what do you think it's going to take as an industry for us to dissolve this line?
I think it's happening already. I think a lot of the folks who are really on the cutting edge right now of integrating whatever, ChatGPT, Claude into their personal work. They know like this is coming, right? This idea that anyone can build an app now if they wanted to. Anyone can code. You don't have to know how to code, but you can prompt the LLM and it will give you code snippets and you can copy and paste, right? And I love that because that's how I learned. I learned by like copy and pasting code, actually like typing code out of like an idiot's guide to HTML5. Like literally what you do that whenever, and anyone starts to learn how to program, unless it's in an academic setting, you're always copy and pasting shit online that you don't understand. And then you copy paste that thing and you're like, oh, I don't quite like this. So I'm going to figure out how to tweak this one like variable, whether it's like, you know, a blogger theme or like a Zanga theme or LiveJournal theme, right? You just want to make it yours, add that sparkle here. And I think that's like, that's really a big part of, to me, what it's like to work with an LLM today. If you don't know how to code, it's like you're going to be like, oh, how do I build an app? It's going to give you this thing. And you'll be like, okay, I guess I'll like copy and paste it into Xcode. And you'll be like, run. It's like, okay, wait, it's not running. It's not running. I'm seeing this. And it's teaching you this feedback loop that all engineers go through, which is like this idea. You read something, you evaluate it, you process it. You kind of like enter this like loop, right? This iterative loop with your computer where you're like debugging stuff, you're console logging, print statements, whatever, just to figure out like, okay, how do I get this thing that's in my brain? How do I get it to work reliably on this computer? So I think that's like, to me, the really like fuzzy line that's blurring right now is, again, if I were to talk to most people in the industry today and I was like, oh, I don't spend that much time in Figma, they'll be like, oh, well, you're not a designer, right? That's to me, that's the line that's blurring. It's because the tools themselves are the thing that are kind of like blurring, right? Because all of a sudden the bar for entry is lowering drastically for anyone to get in. You still need to be an expert, right? There's still a really high ceiling for all of these tools. Someone who learns programming from AI is going to get like pretty good at it, but there's a certain level where you're going to have to do the exact same studying that someone else who's a, you know, more experienced engineer, traditional engineer, had to do. You're just doing it instead of like Googling Stack Overflow, you're just doing it through a bot that was trained on Stack Overflow, right? So the process of learning is easier, right? But the tools themselves, more or less, to me, are staying constant. And I know like a lot of tools these days, like incorporating, you know, AI functionality into them, I haven't really seen anything particularly convincing to me that it's going to be like game changing, right? To the tool itself, right? The only thing that I use day to day that's AI, besides just like, you know, using Perplexity, like Google code questions, is Copilot, right? And Copilot within VS Code, it's like code completion. So it's really saving you that shortcut of going to Google and looking something up or even just sitting down and like writing it out yourself. This is all stuff that you should still know, but like the feedback loop is just being like shortened massively.
For anyone listening, we're recording this a month before Config. So it will be kind of interesting to see like if a big play happens, but I agree. There's so much anticipation for how AI is going to impact the day-to-day life of a designer. And yet it's not really here. Like there's not a breakthrough use case, maybe a little bit into web design, but like for product designers specifically, a lot of it is like, yeah, I can just, you know, interface with ChatGPT and spin up like a framer component, for instance. And that's exciting. But I do kind of wonder like where this goes, because the thing that I'm not interested in is like full end-to-end no code solutions. Because I don't see how that can take hold in modern tech teams where we're just like replacing the developer altogether. I'm more interested in like, what are the tiny ways that we can just get designers over the hump to start contributing towards production without syntax being the blocker?
I think that's a great framing. We could talk about this for hours, how, you know, the introduction of AI is changing like software development at so many levels, right? Because we're currently talking about, okay, assuming the final product is the same, that we're still shipping the same type of products, software products, here's what might change in terms of process, right? Here's what might change in terms of the tools you use day to day, how you approach things. But we should really take a step back and be like, what is actually going to change about the end result? When I saw GPT-4o, I was like, it is subsuming a lot of use cases out there that people are building for. Right, it is just way better at a whole chunk of stuff that in the past you would have like hired these jobs out to different tools, but now you can just go through one interface, and eventually the idea, right, with like agents and like tool use, that eventually it will just be able to like pick those tools for you. If you even just think about the idea of like Figma, if you're designing an AI interface today in Figma, like let's just take chat interfaces for example, because there's lots of ways to implement AI, but chat interfaces seem to be the primary way you do. There's not much UI, right? There is a text box. There is maybe a voice input, a video input, a video output, like as we saw in the demo yesterday. It's like a really simple design. It's like black circle, like animates a little bit. Okay, that hasn't really changed much in like a year since it launched. To me, and this goes back to why like I've always had this hard time with this like limitation of like designers draw pictures and engineers ship code. To me, the product and software design of this new GPT-4o model is as much the behavior as it is how it looks, right? And so this is a segue to me into this, like, I guess my rant about, you know, I've seen some tweets recently about this idea of like, hey, like, you know, if you have this new design engineering role, you're losing one of the benefits of having split design versus engineering, is that designers shouldn't be hampered by what's realistic today, right? Like you can't foist that responsibility on someone who's supposed to be super creative. And to some extent, I agree. But I don't think engineering is the only thing that holds you back. Like, critique is something that holds you back too. Your own self-judgment, right? And what the market says, what you're reading on Twitter. Like, there's tons of things that contribute to you not being as creative as you can. But I think this idea that if you're splitting up this discipline, somehow you're going to get a better result than having someone in the loop who understands what are the trade-offs we need to make using this technology over here in order to create this experience that I'm dreaming of. Not having this happen in the same brain is going to take you so much longer. I think that, let's take an example again, like ChatGPT 4.0, designers were involved in that process of, should this AI laugh when it's like not sure about something, right? Like they made those decisions intentionally. They trained it intentionally to have this weirdly like sexy voice. Just imagine, you know, this was a much smaller company. You only have a couple members. How much time it would take if you had a designer, like a behavioral designer or a service, whatever, you know, someone who's not necessarily doing mockup, but they're thinking about the system. And then someone who's like, quote unquote, implementing it. Like, imagine how long it would take for them to like keep going back and forth, and how many like mistakes they would make along the way, how many disagreements they would have as human beings. And to me, that's really the benefit of having someone who, I don't like the word design engineering, but like, you're delivering something. And that's why I call myself a software creative, right? Because software is the thing I make. My approach is quote unquote creative, right? Because it's about generating ideas. It's about producing as many different options as we can and seeing what's best and delivering something.
Let's talk about the design engineering thing, because, you know, you obviously identify as like a generalist. I think a lot of other people do. And maybe they even feel seen by the recent emergence of design engineering as a topic. And on the surface, you know, it seems to map to your skill set. So what has been your reaction to this little uptick in dialogue and even the way that we're talking about the role?
This industry has a pretty strong hive mind tendency. If you hang out on Twitter, you get pretty much like blue-pilled or red-pilled by whatever the new thing is, right? It becomes a trend. I think the problem for me with design engineering is many, 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 many fold. First of all, design engineering is not new. Design engineering has a long history in many, many other fields. Because we're so obsessed with new things, there's almost this like arrogant, like, oh, like design engineering is this new thing that we're creating, right? All of a sudden, this is like a new role that's like super innovative and it's going to like change how your company does blah. I have the same reaction to it as I did to design thinking when Ideo kind of crank came up with that, to design sprints when someone at Google came up with that. You're like selling this new idea, right? When you're trying to make something happen. And sometimes people take it like too literally and people don't really, they just look at the surface level of it. They don't really like dig down and see like, okay, what does this actually mean for me? What does it mean for the industry? What is the history of this thing? So that's one reaction I have to a lot of the dialogue out there, is that it feels very surface level to me. The second thing I have a problem with it, which relates to the first one, is this idea of whatever the design engineering roles out there, every time I see a new design job posting that says design engineer, 9 times out of 10, it is not the job that I want. 9 times out of 10, it is a marketing page implementer role, or it is a front-end engineer role with a particular focus on animations and polish. At the end of the day, these are roles that existed before, right? Whether you're a web engineer or you're a front-end engineer, these roles existed. People have been doing this stuff for ages. I could like literally rattle off engineers I know who would be like quote-unquote design engineers, but they're not at the point in their personal life where they feel like they need to like update their job title to whatever the latest industry trend is. Like they're just engineers. Maybe they're a product engineer, they're a software engineer, front engineer, whatever it is, right? The other type of design engineering work I see is basically like design systems. A lot of design systems team, they want to hire design engineering. Ultimately, to me, it's someone who is, again, is a front engineer who is not only implementing the components, but also like designing them and thinking about what the API is, thinking about, you know, abstractions, whatever, right? Yes, that is a very niche skill set. I also don't think that is like the full potential of like a design engineer. Ultimately, the thing that bothers me is that it's missing a huge opportunity. Like if we actually wanted to redefine this role to something new and interesting, it is a really good time to do this, particularly because of all of this AI shit that's happening on right now. It is a really good time to take a step back and be like, okay, like if we were to rethink the idea of like PDE, right, product design engineering today, what would it actually take to ship stuff today? I think I've seen maybe like one job posting in the past few weeks that I was like, hey, like that's actually what I think a good design engineering position is. For someone who generally wants to kind of question, you know, the lines that we've drawn in industry and really develop as a person and be able to work as a journalist, I think these positions are really rare, mostly because the companies that require them are really rare. The best chance you have, like just if you're just like throwing a dart out there, you're applying a job, if you want to have this type of like hybrid journalist role, the best chance you have is to join a startup super early. And the only reason that is because it's just, there's no definition at that point. You can do whatever you want, right? As long as you're contributing to the value of the company. Again, the counterpoint to this person who, you know, I respect the perspective, this idea of like splitting up design and engineering to get like the best result. This role that I want is where the exact opposite is true. You are going to get more benefit because there is a collection, not just one person, a collection of individuals who are able to not only come up with their own ideas, but try them out themselves, right? And they'll, you know, maybe disappear for a couple of days and come back with like, well, check out this prototype. You know, I made this cool thing. How does it feel? I just want to be in a room with a bunch of other dorks and make something cool and keep showing each other and keep trying to like one up each other, right? To make something nice that we eventually like share with the world.
Can we talk a little bit about like the learning journey that has to evolve in order for people to be this type of like generalist and actually bring ideas to life in high fidelity? Because I think a lot of people, you know, maybe are 1-2 years out of a UX bootcamp and they're listening to you talk and it's just like, some of it sounds like Portuguese. What in your opinion are the most important concepts that really matter for someone who maybe now thinks of themselves as like a pure UX designer, but they want to think of themselves more as a software designer or creator?
When I talk about being someone who knows how to both dream of something and also build it, I don't literally mean you have to be like a JavaScript expert. Whenever I work with designers who are maybe like not like technically confident, they don't really view themselves as a coder, I reshape their definition again of what it does mean to be an engineer, right? Again, if you talk to, you know, an engineer from like 10, 20, 30 years ago, they're not going to be necessarily coding, right? They might be an electrical engineer, they might be a mechanical engineer. To me, engineering is a mindset. It is a problem-solving approach, right? It is a very process-driven approach, right? I studied HCI in school, right? So human computer interaction, if you're not familiar, very academic. If you look at the actual learning material that you get in an HCI class, it's like Jacob Nielsen, like interface engineering books. The funny thing about these books is like, if you read them, this is how an engineer without taste has developed a process to get a facsimile of what design is. Because again, engineering is really about this mindset that you have to do things the right way, the proper way, the most performant way. You want to do things in a way that makes the right trade-offs. Things have to be reproducible and solid, right? So even if you describe yourself as an engineer, I don't really care about what tool you use, right? It's really about that mindset. So if you got an engineering job where you're just coding, but you don't have the mindset, I would challenge and see like, are you actually an engineer, right? Or do you actually care about something else? Are you maybe a designer who just happened to go to programming school, right? And that's your tool. And that's why, again, this line is very blurry for me. A designer comes from kind of opposite school. By and large, a lot of designers that I talk to, they have very little patience for the way that engineers think, right? They, like where engineers get kind of excited by like edge cases and like optimization, designers do not, by and large. Designers are excited by this, what if this, right? What if that? What if this? Forget what's realistic today. How can we like push the bounds of stuff? I think it's totally possible for one brain to be able to do both of these things, to dream, but also to like enjoy building. And to me, that's whatever word you call it, technical empathy, technical intuition. Actually, architecture is a great example. Most architects, they went to school, they had to do both. They had to be really good at not only structural stuff, but also about some vision, right? A lot of architects I knew in school, they ended up becoming software designers because that was the only job that was really available post-housing crisis. But I think the mental model is really, really compatible, right? Because again, as an architect, when you build something, you have to think about materials. That is actually part of the design process. Like imagine as a software designer today, when you start designing, your mood board includes quote unquote like materials, thinking about what are the technologies that you want to use to enable your experience? Do you want to use video? Do you want to use audio? Like to me, those are all kind of like software toolbox that every designer I think needs to be familiar with. And the level of which you are familiar with in this toolbox, how deep you want to reach in that toolbox, right? To the point where you're getting into like the nuts and bolts of things. That's I think up to everyone. But I think you need to have this almost respect and this desire to kind of dig into that toolbox. Because I think if you don't, and you're kind of just, hey, like, I'm just going to like stay on Dribbble or like layers.to or whatever, and just like kind of stare at like what other people are making and make these cool, like dribbly, cool animations and stuff, I think that's fine. But I think that is concept art for software, I think is probably a good way to put it. I really encourage you to find some avenue into the quote unquote technical world, which you can really grab onto and become interested in. AI is a good example. You don't have to read AI white papers. Like, I've tried. They're not for me. But I'm always paying attention to everything, right? So for example, when, you know, a new language model comes out, you're like asking the questions, okay, what is actually different about GPT-4.0 to GPT-4? What does it mean to be like multimodal, train on multimodal, instead of this idea of like, oh, actually, no, it's combining DALL-E with like GPT. No, that's not what they did. They trained a new model. It's multimodal by nature, right? What does it mean to train? What is actually involved in training? These are all things that you can go out there. You can find YouTube videos. It's just this idea of have this appetite to like go learn stuff.
Hey guys, real quick, if you know me, then you know I love products. So I want to take just 30 seconds to tell you about three of my favorites. Now, anytime that I'm designing and building a website, you better believe that I'm going to use Framer. I made the switch recently and I'm never going back. Now, once it's time to animate my designs and showcase my work, that's when I'm going to use Jitter. It's like Figma, only for motion design. And every step of the way, I'm going to be using Raycast constantly. It's the cornerstone of how I use my computer and the way that I stay in flow while I work. Now, I hand-selected Framer, Raycast, and Jitter to partner with me so that I could do these interviews full-time. So if you want to show them some love, it would mean a lot. Okay, now on to the rest of the episode. I struggle with trying to figure out how to get more designers to a baseline where they even know which steps to take. Like, I'm thinking of someone who is opening up their laptop on Monday morning, and they have literally no technical empathy. Where do they go from there? You know? And I think that's a pretty big intimidating hurdle for a lot of people. And I'm actively trying to figure out how to make it less scary to build momentum. Because once you have momentum, you can go. Now that I'm at least a little bit comfortable spinning up ChatGPT and having a back and forth about components, getting them even just small chunks into Framer, like, it's really easy to coast once inertia is in place, but getting the wheel spinning is intimidating.
I think anyone who's in this position where they're listening to the podcast, they're like, oh, I want to do something differently. You're already halfway there, right? You already have the intrinsic motivation to whatever it is, like make sure that you have job security, or maybe you actually just have pure curiosity about whatever is going on. That's half of it. The other half of it is knowing what do you do with that innate curiosity. There is no magic bullet answer for that. It's really exposing yourself to as many things as possible. I think a really good example is, like, forget the technical thing, just taste. So I was at an offsite for Linear, our annual comp company offsite, last week, and we spent a lot of time talking about quality, right? Because like Linear is kind of known among the people who know about it as having like high quality stuff, not just the marketing page. Because I think a lot of designers, they hear about Linear and they're like, oh, like the purple, dark purple landing page, right? Because that's kind of how it's memed throughout the industry. But Linear itself as a software is also high quality. It is not flashy. I think a lot of designers enter the onboarding floor, they open up Linear, and they're actually kind of disappointed. They're like, oh, this is what it is? Like, it's basically like a big spreadsheet with a bunch of keyboard shortcuts, right? That type of reaction, I think, kind of belies this difference in understanding of what do you really care about as a designer, right? Are you someone who is purely motivated by visual stuff? Like, for those people, I'm like, cool, do that. You know, like, you don't have to be a software designer. You don't have to necessarily think about software to the level that I like to think about, right? If you purely want to just vibe and like make cool vibey stuff, like, I love that. That is fantastic. And there is a job for you out there to do that. But if you're in the software world, you open Linear and you start to see a lot of the decisions that were made, right? And I'm not like taking credit for any of the stuff. A lot of the core Linear things were made way before the time that I joined. That's what I think people appreciate about Linear as a piece of software, is they use it and they're like, oh shit, this edge case, this one workflow that I thought maybe I would have to do a lot of work for, or maybe I've seen it done in like Jira or some other tool before and it was kind of clunky. Oh, actually, like, Linear thought about that for me. And to me, that's also this idea of creating your own definition of what you are, whether it's a designer, engineer, creative, whatever you want to call yourself. You have some, everyone has some idea of what they want in this world, like what they want to do for a living, what they want to produce, what they want to get from people who they're making things from, right? Everyone has some sort of virtuous feedback loop. If you're in this field and you're listening to this podcast, you care about that. But it takes a while for you to figure out the difference between your ideal and the realities of the industry. And a lot of times you're forced to make sacrifices to shape into something that's going to get you to one thing that you want. And that's why I freelanced for so many years. And last year I had different requirements, right? I was like, okay, I'm about to go through a pretty major medical thing with my family. I needed a little bit of stability, but I didn't want to just make that entire trade-off and like just join a huge company, right? I was like, I think I can still make it work where I still get stability, but I also get what I want, which was always to learn. But at this point, I was like, I've been doing production code for 3 years. What if I interviewed as an engineer? Wouldn't that be cool if I was able to pass like an engineering interview loop at this point? And actually, I didn't actually even think I was going to pass a linear interview. Like that was actually my like reach. I know this team is really smart and they have a really high bar. And I really wanted to just test myself. And it was fun. It was fun for me to like go through that process because it was this test, right? If you watch like any sort of like anime or manga, there's always this like training sequence, right? Where like in Dragon Ball Z, like Goku goes for like a training montage. That's me right now. Like I'm doing my like training arc of like if I join a company as an engineer, how deep can I go here? Such that when I come back out to breathe, like whatever is next, I want to take that and bring it next. Because I don't know if I want to be a true engineer at the end of the day, right? To me, I still really love designing. Still really love like thinking about it. And I can do that today still as an engineering job. The way we kind of made this role work for me was like yes, I would be at the end of the day, I'm doing a lot of code. I'm still like on the rotation for triage and stuff like that. I'm doing a lot of engineering stuff, and that's why I wanted to do. But at the end of the day, my unique thing that I bring to Linear is that I can do both and that I am able to speed up the implementation and iteration speed for a lot of things that require this design-backed front-end engineering skill set.
I want to talk a little bit more about how you collaborate with designers at Linear specifically, because if I'm a designer, I have some expectation of owning the creative process and the ideation process. What is that like for you, being on the other side now in this engineering box?
I work with a designer, Danny Warner Smith. He actually used to work at Facebook. We actually met 2 years ago on another client. He just happened to be the designer that this client hired, and I happened to be the kind of engineering person that this client hired, and we ended up working together really well. So he and I work really closely. Basically, every major project that I've done so far at Linear has been with Daniel. So for example, the timeline redesign we shipped earlier this year, Daniel was the design lead for that. It's just the two of us. We have like support, we have a head of product we work with. We have someone on customer experience that works with us as well. But, for the actual like execution, this IC work, classic software design IC work, it is just us two. And the way the work is split up is pretty blurry. Even though this whole time I've been like, oh, being a designer doesn't mean you're in Figma all day, and being an engineer doesn't mean you're in VS Code all day. Like that is actually what it is like. Funny enough, like I'll be super honest. Like Daniel spends all the time in Figma, and I spend all my time in VS Code. And we spend so much time DMing each other, like literally just being like, Daniel yesterday just like sent me some random screenshots and videos, like, what do you think about this? And I'll be like, and I'll give my feedback as a designer and as an engineer sometimes when I think it's valuable. So for example, like yesterday we were talking about, so we're working on project dependencies right now. It's not really a secret. It's something that we're working on, like a Gantt chart style, right? If you're on the timeline, you connect one project to the other, you show that there's some dependency, and if you like move the bars in a certain way where like all of a sudden the dependency is violated, it should like turn red and like warn you or something, right? There's a lot of edge cases for this experience, right? So that's an example of like where he'd show me something and I'd be like, okay, well, like, but like what about like this situation? Thing is important for a customer, right? I'm not picking out edge cases from a technical perspective that are like technical pedantic things, like, oh, like in this case, like it would lead to like this weird bug, right? No, I'm talking about like customer edge cases, right? Things that are really important. But from a technical perspective, I'm thinking about them more because I am someone who still has to reify these requirements into like actual code. So to me, that's really the perspective I bring to the collaboration, where Daniel is really just generating a lot of these visual kind of like artifacts that represent, whether it's a prototype in Origami or like a mock-up in Figma, how something could be. And I'm really offering tons of feedback on, okay, like let's try to reify this a bit into actually thing that I could build. And here's a bunch of my ideas for how to work around some of the things that I see that are maybe missing in the console or kind of going in a slightly different direction. So, for example, traditional Gantt chart, right? You have two project bars, you're connecting an arrow how does that arrow bend, right? To what extent are you curving? If you have multiple arrows coming out of one bar into three different bars, like one project that has three dependencies, do you try to like render them in a continuous way and then split them off intelligently? Or do you just try your best and just do one line independently, right? There's a lot of these tiny little decisions you have to make as a software designer that some of the best software designers I know who would call themselves designers, they would still think through all of these, even though they're not engineers, right? They really have this technical intuition and this empathy to really look at a problem and immediately understand, like, oh, this is going to be important in order to make this thing real. And that kind of thing, honestly, can really only come through experience. Yeah, you can try to study it. You can read case studies out there, but you really have to just do it. And eventually you will figure out and accumulate your own set of experiences that guide you and make you special. Right, in the way that, like, very specifically, example, Brandon Walken, he's one of the guys who really helped make Origami what it was, especially the new Origami studio. I worked with him a bit at Facebook. He was at Apple. He invented kind of like the adaptive pointer for the iPad. And right now he's at OpenAI. He worked on one of the new like voice interfaces. And I think that one of the really concrete moments I remember was when I read one of his specs. At the time, we were still doing handoff through Dropbox, where, you know, a designer would make a mockup or like a video in most cases, actually. They would build something in Origami, record a video, and that would be the spec. And you would also attach like a text document and describe it, right? Like maybe with some timestamps of like what happens in a video, right? This is very like, not that old school, but like fairly old school compared to today. Like there's no optimized tool for sharing prototype videos and annotating things that happen at certain points. And I remember reading his spec for, this was a, how do you click into a group in Origami, right? Is it like a double click? Is it a click and then another click? You know, like how do you actually enter a group and select layers within that group? Like Figma has this behavior. I'm sure they went through the same process. But he wrote this almost page-long tech doc spec of like what should happen in all the edge cases. And he didn't write any of the code, but he thought through it all because he built an Origami. He had to think through it all because in order to make a high-fidelity prototype, he had to think through all these examples. And the thing is that the quality of that interaction dependent on the designer having to go through that process of, okay, I had this idea this of one click for everything, no double clicks in this. I'm not saying this is what Brandon thought, but like let's just say, for example, like I want to make sure that there's no like hidden gestures people have to learn. You don't have to like hold command key like you do in Figma, right? To like click into a group, right? Like I want to make it so that you click once to select the group and then you can click again to select inside. But then along the way, you have to make a lot of decisions. Oh, actually, how do you know that now you're in this mode where you can like, click in again? And how do you make it so that you can still interact with the group as a whole? If you want to resize the group, but then there's a layer within that's in the corner of that group. When do you grab that layer versus still grabbing onto the group? There's all these like tiny little edge cases that you just don't really know until you start to build it out. And I think that's why like a lot of design tools, they're adding more prototyping capability because it is so important to software design, right? Like by the time you hand this off to an engineer, if they're the ones who have to come back and ask you about these edge cases, to me, that's too late. At that point, you're going to be really reactive. You're going to be making all these compromises because you're like, oh shit, like I'm blocking this engineer. Whereas like, you know, to me, the design starts and ends still in this phase where you're considering like all these decisions. And those are the decisions that make it distinct. And that's why like when I brought up the example of linear being like high quality, because at the end of the day, it's a big spreadsheet. But like there's all these small decisions they make that were like appropriate for the workflow. And sometimes it's not. Sometimes we get users, actually a lot of times we get users who are like, it doesn't work for like my particular use case. And then we're like kind of like, can we actually modify this in a way that can like accommodate this user, but still like not lose the intent of like what we originally wanted. That's like constantly something that we have to think about. And a lot of times we can. A lot of times we can kind of like be like, oh, like we made some assumptions 3 years ago and actually that's not really true anymore. Let's void that assumption and like kind of build with this new workflow in mind.
It's cool to hear your perspective because like a few seasons ago, we interviewed Adrian to talk about creating the initial visual language. And now we get to kind of hear from you and some of the newcomers of like what it's like to inherit that. I want to ask just like a couple quick personal questions to wrap up here. The first is you're roughly 8 months into this journey now. When you kind of reflect on it and what it's been like to pull yourself out of a comfort zone, what are some of the ways that you feel that you've already grown through this experience?
To me, the thing that I have learned while working at Linear is not the thing that I expected to learn, right? I came here and I just wanted to purely just be around an environment of engineers and just absorb as much like engineering knick-knack pedantic knowledge as possible. Like I wanted to come out and like have really high confidence that I was a a really good engineer because I worked at a company with really good engineers, right? That's at the end of the day, the process I wanted to go through and the vibe that I wanted to come out with for me, right? Again, the anime training arc. I wanted to go away and come back with superpowers, really. Like what I'm actually finding out is that there's no like magic ingredient, right? Like if I sit there and study all the code, I'm not like getting any particular new insight, but it's actually more the approach of like the care that we put into the product. Like this is one of the few startups that I worked at this scale. Like certainly you will see this at scale of like 10 or less, right? There's so few people, the founders are still writing code. Like definitely you'll see this, but at the scale where there's 60 people at Linear now, but there's still this like almost founder level of care into everything.
Maybe before I let you go, I want to end on one question that I really like to ask people. And I'm particularly interested in your vantage point as someone who is wearing both of these hats. What's something that you personally believe about design that you think a lot of other designers might disagree with?
Whenever you're doing design, the making, the realizing, or I've been using the word reifying, of that design is just as important as the idea. If you go through an UI design bootcamp or you study it yourself, a lot of times you really think that design ends when you like hand it over to engineering. And that's again why partially I'm glad that there's this discussion about blending design and engineering, but if the end result of that is just a bunch of beautiful micro interaction implementation as a job, to me that's not it. That's not what I thought was missing from design the whole time. To me, what was missing the whole time was this idea that you're a software designer now. I really want everyone to just like software as a medium, right? I really sympathize because a lot of people, especially in my kind of tenure range, we all joined the tech industry post housing crisis. Truly, a lot of people joined tech because there was no other option. They could not do the graphic design job that they studied for. They could not do the industrial design job that they studied for, right? And so there was a period of time where you had a lot of people who actually just didn't really care about tech, didn't really care about software, joined the industry. There is a generation of people who joined tech because they watched a Social Network. And that is crazy to me. One, glad for you, live your life, do whatever you want, right? Like makes you happy, go for it. But like, that's not software to me. Like that's like, I genuinely love technology. If you talk to some of the folks who are at the peak of the industry or game or whatever, you will find this similar like passion for the craft of things. Maybe they have a different approach. For example, like Andrew Allen, you know, who's doing all the not boring stuff. He and I, pretty different approaches, right? But both of us like genuinely like the stuff that we're doing, right? I just wish more people were okay with acknowledging that software is code. And you just open your mind a little bit to what you could do if you just knew a little bit more about how it all worked. I have a video that I posted, is on my Twitter pin, about like GPU and shaders. There is a whole bunch of stuff that you could design if you just understood what the difference was between how a GPU works and therefore what a shader does and works, and how that differs from a traditional CPU, right? Step-by-step versus parallel stuff. There are just genuinely like things that you will unlock in your brain once you understand how the material works. If everyone who cared about this concept of design engineering, everyone who wants to like expand the discipline, like mix them two a bit, is just like take the step to just think, here's a really good opportunity. The next 5-10 years, AI language learning model, like take the time and learn what AI is. Rightfully, a lot of creatives right now are like threatened by AI, right? They're really upset, you know, because the stuff that it produces, one, it's going to put them out of a job, but two, it's also just not that good. Like oftentimes you can really tell AI stuff is just like really soulless. There are also artists out there who understand those two things and also see that it's possible to shape these models to a way that benefits their craft, right? And I think you must be able to hold these kind of opposing narratives in your brain. Like all of these things can be true at the same time. And I think that's like the next kind of like big opportunity. Designers who are really, really integrated at the forefront of developing new language model, not even language model, any sort of new model behavior. You're very much participating in how this model is going to work. And you're really helping to really design that. And you understand what does it mean to have really good training data? What does it mean to fine tune? What does it mean to give control to the end user, like through like prompting? Anyone who's going to school today and just joining the industry, that's going to be so important to you, to be like a quote unquote like AI native. Just the same way that any designer that graduated like mid 2010s, you were pretty much expected to be like a mobile native. When I joined the industry, mobile was not accepted as a thing. Responsive design was like a totally new thing. Some blogger or book, some writer like came up with this idea, right? Like it was not a thing when I went to school. Everything was desktop, fixed size. And so like being able to dig into what quote unquote AI is, like just unbundling that, right? That's what I hope and wish for the field, is really just this broadening of what each of us feel like we're responsible for. Because I think like the more that we overlap, the more that we understand what everyone each other cares about, the better we get at the thing we do.
I love that. I know for sure we could keep going for another hour. I'm going to draw the line there. Julius, this has been so good. Like, you have such a unique perspective on your craft and even the broader industry as a whole. Thank you for coming on today and sharing it. I think people are going to get a lot out of it. And I'm hopeful that this is going to inspire a bunch of people to just step out of their comfort zone and embrace like even like this generalist skill set and getting more familiar with like the materials and all the things that you're talking about. Thank you for sharing a little bit about what's on your mind today.
Hey, it's Rid. Don't forget, each week I send an email to over 10,000 designers with featured resources and key insights that you can use to take a leap forward in your career. Head to dive.club/email if you want to sign up. I'll see you next week.